Hello and welcome to the podcast for episode 203, Useful Occupations and Deceptions. I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outlander television series, and I'm joined today by Ann Kinney, my fellow executive producer and the writer of this episode. Hello, Ann.
Hello, Ron. How are you?
Good. All right, well, this is an interesting show. This one went through a lot of changes. There's something about the third episode of a season that sort of compels us to work it over and over again in multiple ways.
Yes, and I wrote the third episode of the first season,
yes, this
too.
Is true. You did do that. Oh, well, the first thing you might notice is that we've changed the main title here quite a bit. We decided to incorporate a lot more sort of pieces of French imagery into the main title, and then transition into a French language version of the song. I just thought this was an interesting idea to sort of acknowledge that, you know, the series was changing and evolving and move the audience more clearly into the French part of the story and sort of drop some of the Scottish-only imagery that defined the main title since season one. But rest assured, some of the Scots imagery will return and there will be more things as the title evolves over the course of season two. I believe the main title card was shot by Matt.
Mm-hmm,
I think Matt did this.
We spend a lot of time mulling over and talking about what those main title cards are going to be. They take up a fair amount of time.
Yes, much to the chagrin of the entire production team. It's like, oh my God, do we still have to do these fucking main title cards?
And honestly, yeah, they're hard for me to think of too, so I'm always happy when somebody else comes up with a good idea.
Now, this opening, as I recall, this is one of the things that kind of stayed throughout all the different drafts, right? Didn't we always sort of have this idea of Jamie coming home, and then this was to sort of establish that, oh, this is his new life with
right.
Prince Charles.
And to kind of, in this episode, as the title sort of tells us, to also establish that while Claire is very much behind this plan that they have, he's really in the position to be much more the actor in this plan, and she has to play a little bit more of a backseat role, which is hard for Claire because that's not really what she does.
Yeah, this was sort of picking up on a thematic aspect of the book, was that when Claire, in these many months that Claire is in Paris, she was kind of bored, and
yeah.
She was at loose ends because Jamie, in the book version of events, is told from Claire's point of view, and so Jamie just keeps leaving and having these meetings off camera, you know, with Prince Charles and working at the wine business and then coming back. And Claire was left to her own devices to a large extent and trying to sort of become, you know, part of the social fabric of Paris of the day, but also finding a lot less satisfaction in that role.
And I think one of the things that was tricky for us when we were trying to do this is that we wanted to explore what you just described without her seeming. We kept struggling between, well, but we don't want her to be like, I'm bored, when he's so involved in this
right.
big, heavy thing. So we didn't, you know, it was really trying to find our way through that to make you sympathetic to her, yeah, without her seeming like she was sort of complaining somehow.
Yeah.
At some point, and I think it's in this scene, he talks about a mad gallop here and a mad gallop here, and just watching it and also remembering writing it, wow, there is so much information that we're communicating in these scenes that it really felt like a mad gallop as you're writing it, like, ah!
This was shot as part of the super block of three at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is in that still that massive shoot that we were doing to start the season with.
And I was not there for the shooting of this one.
Right.
These costumes are just, oh my God, all the way through this, one dress after another, she looks so amazing. And so does he. I miss his kilts, honestly.
Yep.
But he looks pretty darn good.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is a bit of a fashion show, you know.
Ah.
Like one thing after another, and a lady of her station at this point would have had, you know, a fairly wide wardrobe.
Yeah, and the art direction, the apartment is so beautiful. It was fun to go when I went, and this was still up, this set, and it's spectacular.
Yeah, it was a great, great set.
This is one of those things, Sonny is one of those things that, you know, sometimes we take things from different books, and you'll find them, I think sometimes people go, oh, I miss this or I miss that, and I would say to them, well, don't give up hope because, man, we pull things from all over the place because now Sonny has made an appearance here that I'm not sure he was actually in this.
I don't think.
I think he originally in the books, he tells her about Sawney back at Lollybrock in the first book.
Yeah.
So we brought him back here.
Yeah. I think we were just looking for some. I think we were looking for something for Fergus to steal.
Yes. Right?
That's
right.
How it came up. We were saying, right. Wouldn't it be good if he stole something from Jamie too? What could he steal from Jamie?
Right.
Oh, somebody said Sawney the Snake.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think somebody said it as a joke, and we all kind of went, "No, actually, let's make it Sawney the Snake."
I love this scene, and this is one of those scenes that, for me as a writer, is really fun because we took the discussion between Mary and Claire about what French men do in bed is in the book, but in the book it's just the two of them. So it was fun to include Louise, who's sort of acting out the stuff that is in Claire's head. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? We get to kind of see it dramatized. Plus, we had a piece of information at the end of this that we needed to get across. So it's that fun kind of puzzly thing, you know, where it's very satisfying, at least for me, and I think probably for you too as a writer, to I've got these elements that need to happen in this scene, and how can I do it in the most elegant way? And I was happy with how this turned out.
I love Mary. She's tiny. The actress is tiny.
Rosie is. She is really tiny. We always joke that we're just going to put her in our pocket. She's tiny. And Claire Sermone, who plays Louise, is also terrific. I really love her.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
See, this is where we wanted to make the connection for Claire, that she remembers where Mary's from, and so that's how we got there. It was like, I'm from this place, and that makes Claire remember this, and I thought that, I was happy how that all worked out.
Yeah, and I remember us going through many iterations of this.
Oh, yeah.
What was it that triggers Claire to remember, and how do we get to that place, and it was just a lot of conversation.
Yep. And at one point, I think she saw this, it was in Master Raymond's shop, he had a Bible that
that's
made her
right.
think
it was
of
a Master Raymond.
Yeah. And the other thing I like is I really like that we, how we've kind of continuously fleshed out the relationship between Claire and Frank, and you really see that that was, they loved each other.
Yeah.
I think sometimes when you have romantic triangles in stories and movies, one of the characters is kind of a paper tiger, where mm-hmm. you think, he's never going to be the
like,
winner.
That's not a legitimate choice.
Yeah, and it diminishes the character, I think, and makes the challenge less, so I'm happy that we've been able to do that.
Yeah, it feels like a real triangle.
This also was a sequence, the editing, and I think you must have constructed this too. This was a giant voiceover speech where she's doing all this explaino.
Right.
And it was just, when I wrote it, she was in the carriage, and she's just, you're hearing the voiceover. And when I saw this cut, I was like, oh my God, that's great, because you're giving us all these visual cues to help us track this story.
Yeah,
so,
it was tough to track it otherwise, because it was just so much information. And again, it's voiceover, so you're not even watching her talk.
Yep.
And tracking all the names and the people and trying to keep it clear in your head.
No, that was a really great thing to do.
He's great.
Yes.
I love this line coming up where he says,
"The
search for the little snake continues." Where did the idea of Murtaugh and Suzette come from? That was something early on, wasn't
it? Well, I was thinking about that. One thing that we did talk about at one point was that Murtaugh would have sort of an unrequited love for Mary.
Oh, that's right.
Mary
we were going to have him. Yeah, that's right. He was going to have a thing for Mary.
Yeah, which I loved. It's all
yeah,
in
the,
you
too.
Know, kind of the, yeah, that kind of Jane Eyre, you know, kind of the guy, the gruff guy
longing
for the sweet girl. And we had that carded out and all of that. I do not remember why, probably real estate as much as anything. And then we came up with Suzette. And again, this for me is one of those scenes where the purpose of this scene in terms of the plot was that Claire has to tell Murtaugh, Blackjack's alive, I haven't told Jamie, and he tells her it's okay. And then we embellished it all by giving him Suzette and having the discussion going toward, gee, do you disapprove? And then in the next scene, we need her to get to Master Raymond. So we have her say, I'll go get some birth control for Suzette. You know what I mean? And I love that kind of stuff where you kind of, because you do have to have the connections. And again, Duncan is wonderful. He's fabulous.
I know, and they had such good chemistry in all their scenes. I was happy to. It was like, yeah, let's keep playing. Let's play some more Murtaugh and Claire stuff.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it's funny. I was thinking about this because going down the road in a later episode, there is a sort of like almost homage to that notion of Murtaugh and Mary. I don't want to blow it.
Oh, right. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Which I wrote, and I don't think I even thought about it, but in retrospect, I go, oh, that must have still been kicking around in my head.
I bet you're right. This is one of those annoying things that happens sometimes in production. It's annoying to the writers. You know, when there was a pass we worked on this scene where I specifically said Claire and Murtaugh go out onto the balcony to have this conversation because Gary Steele, our production designer, had built this balcony off of this main room where you could stand out on the courtyard. It was a practical balcony, and it was like kind of cool, and no one had used it. And I said, let's get out, let's use this fucking balcony.
Right.
And of course, then the director just kept it all in the room. and as a result, the balcony is never used in the entire show.
That's hilarious.
We built this stupid thing, and it's really cool, and it was out on the courtyard. And I was like, this is the chance, we're going to use it. And of course, let's keep them inside.
It's honestly amazing how often that happens when you have a set and you think, oh, we need this and this and this and we're going to go over here, and then you don't ever use it.
I know. You build all these things into the sets, and then the next thing you know, you just never even shoot that side. I feel like we shot, except for the balcony, we probably shot everything of this apartment, because the main staircase is used, the courtyard, the hallway to the main staircase. There's this room, the parlor. The bedroom and the dining room are the same part of the set that are just redressed to be the dining room or the dining room or the bedroom, sorry. And then there's like a hallway that goes all the way around all the sets.
Right, and later in this you'll see that we use the hallway in a really interesting way where Claire's in the room and Jamie's in the hallway and we're going through the doorways, which is cool.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, because I know we talked a lot about what was Murtaugh's reaction going to be when she tells him the blackjack's alive, and should she or shouldn't she tell Jamie, because I think, again, this is another one that I don't think this is in the book. I mean, blackjack being alive is in the book, but no, you know what, in the book, she and Jamie see, don't they see him at the same time, or they see Alex at the same time, who in the book looks exactly like blackjack.
Yeah, they both encounter Alex at Versailles, and Claire faints. Because she thinks it's Blackjack, because he looks so much like him. But in the show, it was just like, you couldn't go to that card again. You couldn't have Tobias play three roles. That was pushing it.
No, which is one of the interesting things, again, in the adaptation process. This room is fantastic.
This room is in Prague. This was a real library in Prague. There's like two main rooms to it. There's another room next to this one that's also spectacular. But this was an unbelievable location.
Again, this is another one of those scenes that we had a lot of information we had to get across, so how do you do it in an interesting way? And also, I don't play chess. So, for me, it's sort of like, if you've ever written on like a medical show or something, where the part where they're talking about the medical, you just write, tech, and somebody else comes along. And this one, you came along and came up with the Spanish game. Which, I think I know like things like, checkmate.
Star Trek, I used to just literally, I would do the same thing. You'd write tech. Mr. LaForge, tech the tech of the main engine. But Captain, if we tech the tech will overload. And then Data would say, but Captain, there is a theory. If you tech the tech, it will actually, and you're just like, it's a page of tech.
Well, because usually also when you use your technical advisors, like going forward when we get into the scene with Master Raymond and she's asking them about all the herbs and what they do, you often go to your technical advisor and say, this is what I need to have happen in this scene.
Yeah.
They need to discuss this, it needs to do that, so I need you to help me figure out what those things are. And, you know, you're always lucky when you get somebody who can really roll with it.
Yeah, because a lot of it is just rhythm. It's the rhythm of the dialogue. He needs to say this kind of thing and that, and it needs to sort of make sense, but it's really about the rhythm of the scene and what it's accomplishing above and beyond the technicalities.
Yeah. How was it... You were in Prague. Were you in Prague?
Not for the shoot, but I went to Prague for the initial scout.
I mean, so what was your sense? How much of our crew from Scotland went to Prague?
Not many. I mean, the key department heads went, and I think each department sent a few key players, you know, hair and makeup, and people from art department, people from costume, and then there were a lot of local hires in Prague, because there's a fairly substantial film community in Prague, so a lot of people we could hire on the spot, and all the extras were obviously hired on the spot, and dressers and people, you know, for set deck, but we had our people sort of going there ahead of time to sort of set everything up and then to be there on the day of filming as well.
Right, and do you have a sense of how the Prague crew and like extras and stuff compared to Scotland? Not in a negative way, but were there things that were different about dealing with that?
No, I didn't hear much of that. It seemed like they were familiar enough within the EU, they all kind of work together a lot, and there's a lot of productions moving back and forth. So I think everyone was kind of familiar with the conventions of filmmaking in Europe, and so I don't think there was that big of a cultural change. I think it was less dramatic than those of us coming from the US going to England and realizing, oh, wait, there's different terminology and different customs and different things. I think within the European film community, they were all kind of on the same page. This is actually a redress of the courtyard set at the Paris apartment. So this is supposed to be an outdoor market outside of Master Raymond's, but this is actually a redress of our courtyard back on the sound stages in Cumbernauld. So Claire and Jamie's apartment is upstairs on the second floor of this set.
The man who plays Raymond, Dominique Pinon, is that correct?
Yes.
Quite an accomplished French actor.
Very
he's
much.
Very well known in France.
Yeah.
And we have our lovely Stanley Weber.
Yes.
The Comte, he's fabulous. Now he speaks, you were talking about French. I think what we decided was, because of who he is, the Comte always speaks French.
Yeah.
There's a point at which he's told you speak English, but I don't think
right.
I think that's the only time.
That's the only time.
Because we felt like he so dislikes Claire and Jamie, it was sort of a part of his disdain for them that he could speak English, but he wasn't
going to. He wasn't going
anymore.
To.
I'm interested in stuff about pregnancy from happening.
There was a whole beginning to this to this scene that got cut. I think it was cut for time, and as we were going through trying to get the show to time, I found a place to cut in much deeper with her just saying that line and having him up on the ladder, but there was a whole intro that they walked in and chatted, as I recall.
Yep. And again, this is one of those places where we got our technical advisor, our herbalist, helped us out with what specifically they would be talking about.
And this whole thing with the bitter cascar is drawn pretty much directly from the book, as I recall.
Yep.
Oh, and I forgot to mention I'm drinking Square One vodka today.
Oh, is that what you're drinking?
That's what I'm drinking.
Yes.
Instead of the Scotch whiskey. And the smoking lamp is out.
I love her cloak here. It makes me think of the one from French Lieutenant's Woman. She puts that big
over
her head. That's fabulous.
Yeah, it's a great cloak.
What happens to all these costumes? We won't go back to France. She didn't bring them back with her. What do we do with all of these?
They'll be kept and stored, and you know, some will go on display. Some will become part of the Sony archive, like the key ones, like you know, the big red dress.
Mm-hmm.
The red dress from Versailles will be one of those iconic costumes that they'll save and show forever. Some of these might be repurposed. You know, Terry's talked about, especially the extras costumes from Paris and the day players costumes from Paris, can be repurposed and taken apart, put back together for America when the show gets to America, because essentially the colonies were using the same kind of clothing.
Right.
And the principal characters, I think, kind of varies from costume to costume. I don't know, you know, like this particular one is a good question. Would that be saved? Is that just going to end up taken apart and becoming something else? Or I don't know.
And do you know if they, you know, like when the show ends, would Sony like rent them out to people, or
they probably don't. I don't know that they rent them out. They might sell some of them, because now it's become more of a thing in film and TV that there's money to be made in auctioning off props and wardrobe.
That's interesting.
So I wouldn't be surprised at all at the end of the show that some of these costumes are eventually auctioned off to private collectors. Mm-hmm. And people make an argument about, oh, that's terrible, the studios should keep all that, they should be kept in archives. And
where would they but keep it?
Yeah, and the truth is the studios don't take care of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They get thrown into warehouses and they get moth-eaten, or rats take over.
Yeah.
And actually costumes and props in private hands are probably much more cared for and looked after and preserved. This is also in Prague, the exterior of the Hôpital, is a street in Prague. We did surprisingly little VFX work here. There's just some stuff to sort of take out some 20th century, 21st century or 20th century antennas and gutters and that sort of thing. And we sort of dirtied up the buildings to make them look a little bit more worn, because they were kind of clean when you shot them originally.
This whole thing at the L'Hôpital des Anges, and I've just exhausted my French.
Yes.
I love this in the book, and it was really fun to
is great.
To be able to do this. And the woman that we cast, Frances de la Tour, for Mother Hildegard, and we saw a lot of really good actresses.
Yeah.
People that you've seen before, and she's just terrific.
She's wonderful. Now, the interior of the hospital is actually in Scotland. This is a cathedral that Gary Steele found. I can't remember the name of this. But this
I
is
believe
a,
it's Glasgow Cathedral.
Is it Glasgow Cathedral?
I think
okay.
That's what,
great. And then we came in and brought in all the set dressing and the props and so forth.
This is one of those things, too, where, you know, when you're writing, you know, I'm obviously picturing in my head between the book, which is describe things, and then you're picturing it. And then, because this scene was also longer. Remember, it went on a lot longer where you see her going behind Sister Angelique and cleaning out bedpans and all that kind of stuff. And then you realize when you start to see it that so much of that, you get it without having all of that information. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Visually, it tells you so much. Even though I've been doing this for a long time and it's a visual medium, I still find myself sometimes you can kind of really rely too much on the words or you feel like I've got to put too much in here. Because again, I think you get all the value that we wanted, but it's in a little more condensed form.
Yeah, that's true. It's always it's a continual learning experience.
Yeah.
You think you need to explain things, you think you need to talk about it, and then you see the film, and you go, no, I don't.
Yeah,
you don't.
It's amazing. And you'd think after doing this, I mean, I've been doing this for 20-plus years, you
think,
oh, boy, next script, I'm not putting, there's no fat in that script.
And no, you're just always writing too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was that section, that cut right there. There was an extended walk and talk with Claire following behind Sister Angelique. And
Right, we come right into this, but now we go, yeah.
This was a difficult piece of editing, actually, in that the eye lines didn't match up. Where Claire was looking off camera there, she was not actually looking at Mother Hildegard in that shot. We stole that from an earlier scene, but we wanted, because I think what Claire was looking at, she was looking at another patient being tended to by another person, but it was confusing in the way it kind of cut together, so we had to manufacture that look from Claire to Hildegard. But is this piece drawn for the book?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I can't, every time she puts her finger in this and tastes it, it kind of like, I flinch every time.
I just say to myself, urine is sterile, urine is sterile.
It's
very weird, yeah. But that's right out of the book. This is funny too, because I remember, and I probably put it in the script that she steps aside, but I remember thinking, God, I hope they have her speak quietly to Mother Hildegard when she basically says, this woman is not going to survive.
Right.
And they did it beautifully, but there was a moment where I'm thinking, gosh, I hope she just doesn't say it out loud in front of this poor lady.
She's done.
Yeah, moving on.
Why are you wasting the bed space on this?
Of course, we didn't mention Bhutan.
Oh, Bhutan,
yes.
Bhutan,
who is so cute.
Bhutan has his own fan club.
Yeah, I'm sure. We did see, Tony was there. I know that we saw a number of dogs before we settled on this one.
The dog casting process.
Yes.
Did they all look the same? Were there
There were a variety of dogs. I mean, they were all small, but and I don't remember this dog's actual name. Here we are back at Maison Elise.
Back at the brothel.
And this is our first glimpse of Fergus.
Right. I remember we worked a lot on the politics of all this, trying to figure out exactly how this was all working. You know, what did Charlie need? What did Duvernay think he needed? What was Jamie's sort of, you know, actual motive? How he was going to undermine the Jacobite cause by putting these two together? So it's like all these different layers, and it was wildly confusing. It took forever to try to like make sense of it. Again, because in the book, this whole section is told from Claire's point of view. And so Jamie would come back from these meetings and kind of tell her basically certain things that had happened.
Right.
And then Claire would just kind of tell us. And then months went by and this and that happened. So we didn't really have a strong guide to go by when we were going to open the show up and play these actual scenes with DuVernay and Jamie and the prince. And we had to sort of construct a lot of the sequences and a lot of the plot sort of out of whole cloth, and it just became, it was very complicated.
Right, and looking at what actual history had happened and how we incorporate that. And this was important because now we find out that he's got these investors that Jamie doesn't know about.
Right.
Which will play as we go forward. Yeah, there was a lot of political intrigue stuff that we were going on about.
It's one of the reasons why I just went through a lot of like working it over and over again, to try and make it clear, to make it understandable. And then it was also, this is a, you know, one of those cases where you're working on shows later, you're working on episodes 4 and 5, and things about to happen in the story with Charlie and Wine and, you know, Jamie and Sandringham and all this other kind of stuff. And then as you fix those problems, you realize, well, we haven't set that up properly back in 203. So then you had to go back and rewrite those sections to line up with shows that you were like working.
It was a little bit of a brain cramp, a lot of this. And also, you know, enough information so that people can follow it, but not overwhelming.
Yeah.
Because then it, you know, because a lot of times we had these big speeches and just kind of, what can we take out of here that we don't need? Because it just gets boring.
Because you have to sort of give the audience a history lesson without giving them a history lesson.
Yes.
You know, it's like they have to kind of get some basic concepts here. Who's on what side? Oh, the British and the French. We know they don't kind of like each other, so how does this work? And who are the Jacobites, and why would the French support them, and under what circumstances? And, oh, they're fighting somewhere else in Europe, but not full-on war, because they're still kind of talking to each other, so it's very, like, very dicey stuff. And to make it a scene, you know, you're trying to make it a scene, not just explain the politics of the era.
Yeah, and the whole idea that Prince Charles is in France, but he can't be acknowledged by the king directly, because that was a big political faux pas, because he wasn't really supposed to be. Oh, man, it was, there was a lot of stuff. And a lot of times, again, thank God for good actors, because they seem to understand what they're talking about.
Yeah, they seem to believe it.
And you, even if you can't quite follow it, you can follow their reactions. So when Charles says something and Jamie's like, look, shocked, you go, oh, okay, that's shocking information, even if I didn't quite understand it. Yeah. I mean, hopefully people understood it, but,
I believe this exterior, if I'm not mistaken, of Madame Elise's is actually in Scotland. It's one of the few exteriors that we used in Scotland for Paris. Now this whole section of Jamie coming home, Claire's not there, and then him later being him being annoyed, we had to rework this a bit. In the first cut, you followed Claire into the hospital and came home with Claire to discover Jamie that was really annoyed and unpleasant to her because of what she had been doing. And you kind of felt like Jamie was a jerk. Like, you really had no sympathy for him, and you didn't understand why he was acting the way he was. So then we, this is all, you know, as we watched it, then we said, all right, let's go back. Let's now shoot this sequence here of watching Jamie, you know, wait hours going by and getting more and more frustrated because he has something he has to talk with Claire about. Let's be emotionally with Jamie. So that by the time Claire comes home, we, the audience, have also had to wait and wait and wait, and we know he's upset, and we know he's stressed out about something, so that when he does unload on her, we at least understand, we have more sympathy
right.
for him. I mean, because this was kind of a difficult area of the book to translate, was this whole sort of fight between him and her about
right.
her working in the hospital.
Right, right. And we, in the book, it's more 18th century man, 20th century woman a little bit, and I think because we're more in Jamie's head in our story, we wanted to also discuss how he's feeling about all this, how he's feeling about what he's doing and how this is happening. So that's, yeah, we were putting all that in here. This is also another place where we had to drop in this piece of information that Mother Hildegard is a musical prodigy.
Oh, right.
Because we needed that piece of information in the book. Yeah. You know, she spends time with her, she goes and sees her play the piano, blah, blah, blah. We couldn't do that.
I love her look there. Mm-hmm. Just that little look she gives him, like, oh, come on. Yeah, there is the musical prodigy.
And this, and the niece or something of the Sun King, because we had to have that relationship.
Oh, right,
also.
Right.
This is one of the things I love about the character of Claire, too, is that, yeah, she saw me taste the urine, and I got to Lance a boil, and
yeah.
she's so, you know, yeah, she's not grossed out by any of it. She
she's
loves
so enthusiastic
this.
About
yeah,
it all.
Yeah.
This was all tricky stuff, trying to figure out this part of the relationship between the two of them, to have a legitimate fight, to have an emotional arc, to say, to understand how these two could come apart at this point, come back together later
yes.
in subsequent episodes, and how that was all going to play together. It was very difficult, I found. It was very hard to like work it through. I remember we had a lot of internal discussions. I remember we had extending conversations with the actors
yeah.
about how this was going to work, because they had concerns about, okay, the fight and what is it really about, and you know, where do they end up as people, and how do they move forward with the plot?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it was one of those things that we just had to work over and over and over again.
Well, and one of the virtues and challenges of all these stories after the first book is they're together now, they're a couple, so there is conflict between them,
yeah.
but you can't always have, well, I'm walking out, or I'm not going to be here,
yeah.
and because that's false. It's like you don't believe it, and one of the beauties of the books is these two are a team, and yet you need some conflict dramatically, otherwise it gets a little boring.
Yeah.
So it's
interesting.
Because
there's nothing to play.
And I think we talk a lot in the room, because most of us are married, about, you know, well, if, you know, if I did this, or if my
yeah,
husband
I know.
Or my
it's
wife.
A lot of that.
Yeah, which is, it's helpful, though, because I think most of us are in committed relationships, so it's like, how does that work, that you're your own person, and you have your feelings, but you're not going to blow it up. Do you know what I mean?
Yep. It was also important to give Claire this sort of, you know, this realization that what her life really would be in 18th century Paris,
yeah.
you know, what was the role of a woman, of a wife, you know, in this place and time, and how does Claire get herself into that place, even though she's doing it for a mission, even though she's doing it for this enormous greater good that they're trying to accomplish, how does she reconcile that with who she is as a person?
Mm-hmm.
As I've always said, that, you know, if Claire had not gone through the stones, if she had never had this experience, I think she was going to be pretty unhappy back in the 20th century, as women were sort of then expected to return to a very domestic, you know, life and go back to being housewives and get out of the workforce. And Claire had had this extraordinary experience in World War II, and she wasn't going to do that so easily.
Yeah. I think that's something that's always interesting to me, too, when we talk in the room, because we have to remind ourselves when we say, well, she's from the 20th century, it's like, yeah, but she's from the 40s.
She's from the 40s, yeah.
She's not from 2015, and even as the books go forward, even the 60s, It's better, certainly. And in fact, I would almost argue that the gap between the 40s and the 60s is almost bigger than the gap between the 18th century and the 40s. Do you know what I mean?
In terms
of, well, women's roles, what you were expected and not expected to do? Yeah, I think.
That's an interesting way to look at it, yeah.
So again, we have to remind ourselves that she was, and she was kind of bucking the system, as you say, even in the 40s.
A lot of conversation about when they were having sex and when they were not having sex in Paris, and trying to weave that into the story but not make it the dominant theme of the story. We didn't want the show to be all about when they're going to have sex again.
Yes.
This is an odd little avant-garde piece. I came up with this little notion. We like this idea that at Madame Elise's, they had this little stage, and Gary built this little stage that they would do performances and odd little performance art type pieces for this crowd, this very sophisticated crowd in Paris. And we were looking for something to play here, and I just had this idea about painting a woman, you know, painting the front of a woman on her back and the back of a woman on her front.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that meant or why I liked it, but I just sort of, and then you say that to the production team and they all kind of look at you like, so you want us to do what? How's that going to work? Like paint her front on her back, what?
And I'm sure there were many discussions about, what does that say about Ron?
Yeah, what does that say? What does that say about
life? Do we really want to know? We introduced Fergus, and there you go.
There you go.
In a very different way than he is introduced in the book. Because in the book,
oh, right.
Jamie's being followed by guys from the dock. I mean, we just
right.
have to simplify things.
I forgot about that.
And he's they go after him, and remember there's the whole thing where he has the big sausage.
The sausage fight, yeah.
And then Fergus helps him get away from those guys. Fergus is still a child of the whorehouse.
Of the whorehouse, right.
But, yeah, he helps him get away from those guys. And again, sometimes we just had to simplify things because we just can't get it all in. So we went at it this way.
Yeah, just like get to it. He's a thief. Jamie figures it out. He wants to hire him.
Right. Now, where was this chase?
I think this is in Scotland. I believe this is, I think this is near Sandringham's house, as I recall. The Sandringham's house from season one.
Okay.
Yeah, this is like a back alley section that they were able to kind of cobble together. So you can't really tell that it's Paris or Scotland. It just kind of feels generically 18th century.
Yeah. Our Fergus's. He is French, right? We
yep,
looked at several young men, and they'd be able to speak English as well. The casting process this season was challenging as well.
Yeah, because you had to like go looking in France for,
yeah.
for actors.
Yeah.
Andy's a kid, so there's various work requirements for his kid. How many hours he can be on the set? So, it just becomes wildly complicated.
And it's also, you get into that weird area too, which will happen, again, people who've read the books know where we're going with Fergus, I won't say, but there are things that you also, you can do in a book, because it isn't a real life person, that you're having to say, oh, this is what happens to you,
right.
or we're going to show this.
Yep.
I mean, again, I've been on other shows too, where, you know, some child witnesses a horrific murder,
mm-hmm.
and when you're shooting it, you got a child there, so you're often shooting it in such a way that you shoot the kids' reactions and tell them something really scary is going on, take them out of the scene, and then you shoot it so that you're not traumatizing some child.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting when you work with kids. And there's Sonny.
And there's Sonny. Sonny's okay. Sonny's going to be like R2-D2. He's going to go through the entire series as like one of the only witnesses.
We do laugh that we Jamie has so much stuff in his spore, and it's like Mary Poppins.
It is like Mary Poppins.
Just, he just keeps pulling things out of there.
Sonny. I know.
It's very cozy.
And again, the bedroom and the dining room are the same set. They just get redressed. So she left one. She left
oh, really?
A room,
wow.
Walked back into the same room, basically on a different day.
Yeah, it's so the magic of the movies.
Yeah.
Oh, I know what I'm curious about. When we do scenes like this, mm-hmm. all the candlelight, how much other light is in this room?
There is other light. There are lights in the ceiling that you can't see, and then there's some lights from off camera that sort of are enhancing the candlelight. The candles actually surprisingly provide more illumination than you would think. So when you light that many candles in this room, it does actually light it up. But the DP does enhance and augment it so that there's a sense of shadow and getting light on the actors' faces and so on. So mm-hmm. it's not quite the full kit that you would have if it was a modern show where you're replicating fluorescence and lamps and so on. So everything's a little bit softer and has to have a certain flicker kind of
mm-hmm.
soft feel to it. But yeah.
And those are real candles. That's
real
fire.
Candles.
That's not.
Yeah, we had a whole conversation at the show at the outset before we started about candles and could we get away with artificial candles, because they've made some candles now that actually, some artificial candles that are little bulbs that are LEDs that do have a flicker in them
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
replicate it. But you kind of smoke it out quickly on camera. We
right.
actually did a couple of camera tests. Even in a background shot like this angle where you see the candle in deep background behind
mm-hmm.
Claire against the wall right there
mm-hmm.
on the sconce. Now, you don't really see any flicker in that, and you think that you probably could get away with LEDs
right.
on those candles, and you might, but you kind of see there's a little bit of movement. If
yeah.
you look closely, you kind of see that it moves back and forth just a little bit. And if the camera were to follow Claire out that door,
right.
you would quickly realize that those were fake.
Right.
So we just ended up, we have literally thousands of candles in our
yeah.
in our prop warehouse.
And sometimes when we go on location, it's a problem because the locations won't let us use candles.
Yeah, some locations won't let you have any open flame
yeah.
on some of these historic buildings, and that's another problem. This didn't come off quite as well and clear as I was hoping. I kind of told myself, this is one of those things where when we broke it in the room, you were supposed to see the whole thing. He follows the guy,
right.
he takes the letter out of the guy's bag, the guy's drinking, and then you follow him out and give it to Murtaugh. Then through the production process, someone said, well, do we have to go into the shop because we don't have that location? Can't we just see the messenger go in and Fergus follow him?
Right.
And then Fergus come out with the letter, and
right.
we'll just assume he stole it. And at the time, you go, okay, I get it. Yeah, that should work. And then you watch it and they cut, and you're like, oh, shit, actually.
Yeah. It would have been better to see him take
it. It would have been better to see him take it.
Yeah. Well, many think is another solution then that he had him sit outside the messenger, and then he could take it. I mean, yeah, but
yeah.
in the moment, can't say yes to everything. So.
Yeah, you're always judging sort of what do you think is vital? What do you have to have versus what would be nice to have?
Yeah.
Because production is constantly coming to you and saying, is there a way we can not do this set? Is there a way we can not do this scene? Because we're really over and everyone's tired. And we don't really have this set. It'll cost all this money and push you into another day. And so you're constantly sort of writing that line. Well, I think this is just something that we would like. Yeah, let's cut this part.
Well, and then as you get farther in production too, everything rolls downhill. It's like, well, we don't have time to shoot this scene in this block, so we'll push it to the next.
Yeah.
And pretty soon, that also happens. Things start to just drop off. In a way, you sort of dread having one push because now oh man, that one could very easily go away.
Yeah, because later they'll say, do we really still have to shoot
yeah.
this scene in this block? And
yeah. All this stuff is the book stuff with the music and the notes and trying to kind of decipher that and make it play was a challenge also.
Yeah, because there was a lot more of this
mm-hmm.
even in the book and more of it even in the first drafts of the script of all the letters and the correspondence and what they
yeah.
were saying. And then they were hiding what they were saying, and some of the letters were in code and some were not.
Yeah. And there was a whole scene with Claire, actually, right, where Jamie and Claire at one point were working on it together, and they were talking about trusting people.
Yeah.
And
trying to still work this all into their personal story and where they were in the relationship.
Yeah. Again, this was one of those things that you go, oh yeah, Murtaugh's at the hospital, he could know this.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes that happens too, as you're constructing things and then you look at the stuff on the table and you think, oh wait, that will help us.
Yep. Oh, and I think this whole little thing with Bhutan here is right from the book, right? This is one of those moments, one of those scenes in the book you know you've got to have in the show somewhere, because everyone remembers it. Oh, remember Bhutan? And everyone's like, you got to do the Bhutan thing. And then it was just trying to figure out, where do we do the Bhutan thing? It's got to be here someplace. I wasn't there when they were shooting this, but I can imagine that this was like a nightmare, trying to get the dog. Because he's got to like walk on the guy, he's got to sniff at a certain place, he's got to lie down, he's got to bark. I'm sure this was a nightmare.
Yeah.
And now some gross stuff.
Ugh. Yeah. And some more gross stuff.
Yeah, some more gross stuff.
While the tiny entrance room into the hills came, the deep wound had festered and formed a pocket of pus around the intrusion.
This Katrina, is she... I've never known her to be any kind of squeamish about any of this stuff.
I don't think she is. I don't think she has any problems with it.
Yeah, and even when we have, like, you know, like the cooked rabbits and kind of stuff.
Ugh. Well, day one on the whole show was her in that field hospital of World War II with open wounds and blood spurting everywhere, you know, raw, just really nasty stuff. So I think she got over it really quickly.
Yeah. Sometimes this stuff is tricky too, because when she's doing stuff, like obviously she can't do this on the guy's, you know, leg. So how the makeup works, whether it's actually on his leg and it's something that she's working on top of his skin, or whether it's an actual prosthetic and we're just not seeing the rest of it.
Some of it is shot later, like some of those insert shots of the wound itself were definitely done like weeks after the fact, and not even Katrina's hands, like somebody else's hands.
Oh wow. You know, despite all this, sometimes when you jimmy rig with stuff over and over, in the end it doesn't quite hang together. And I think we ultimately, this was good, his arc of kind of being upset with her and then coming and
making the gesture,
and so it's kind of his way of saying I'm okay with this, which was nice. And this was one of those things from the book too that was fun. This little, again, Diana does these moments of like, Claire knows things. Like you're gonna see what you'll see is that it's my German friend.
Oh, my German friend.
Friend Johann Sebastian Bach, but he'll never be anything.
Yeah,
that stuff's fun.
It's like she does it so infrequently in the books. When she does do it, you get kind of a thrill out of it.
Yep.
Because she doesn't hit the time travel stuff too hard.
No.
And this wasn't it. This is a complicated and interesting idea of a code that is about the key and how many times switching the key was the key to decrypting the whole thing. It's like a wild idea, and I hope it comes across to people that haven't read the book.
Yes.
What's what's nice about the way Diana does this is that that's a moment where we feel superior to her.
Yes.
Right? We and Claire feel superior because we know something that she doesn't.
Yeah.
And she does that so little in the books. There's not that many times where Claire is really looking at these people with superiority. She
yes.
mostly empathizes with them and adapts, and a lot of times she's impressed and trying to catch up with what these people are doing.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of distance to sort of look down at them from a, you know, a future perspective.
Well, I always think that's one of the sort of genius things about having Claire having grown up with an anthropologist, and you know, she lives rough, so she does this stuff doesn't throw her. And yeah, she would have an appreciation of different cultures and that kind of stuff, which is cool. There's another amazing dress. Oh my God, I love that blue and orange thing. That's fabulous. Is Terry like a not flamboyant dresser, but does she like to wear kind of costumey stuff? I've seen her, she's working, so she's usually in very practical clothes.
No, she likes, she's of that sort of, I like to wear black every day because it makes one fewer decision I have to have.
Interesting.
Like a lot of costume designers are like that. And fashion designers, like Michael Kors does the same
thing.
I wear basic black every day because I don't want to think about it. And then they project all that out into the world.
It's really interesting. But it's not enough to fund the Time Lords. So Charles
was lying to them. She was always dressing the kids up.
Oh, really?
She was always, as the kids were growing up, she would make outfits for them and costumes for them. Halloween was like a whole thing in our house.
Halloween must have been spectacular.
Oh, Halloween was amazing. It was always these amazing costumes she would construct for the kids.
Wow, that would be great.
And on Battlestar, she talked to Glenn Campbell, who was our costume designer on Battlestar, and they made flight suits for the kids. Like two little flight suits for each of them. They wore them to Comic-Con one year. And they were tickled, but they were so young, they also were sort of like, these are kind of hot.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, so they grew up with it. So
and they
like, kind of
grew up with it. Yeah, it's like,
do this?
Yeah,
yeah,
a flight suit. Everyone has a flight suit.
Was there any costume other than that you can think of that she made for the kids?
She made like an amazing magician's costume once for and a white queen kind of a snow queen kind of outfit one year. It was an alien costume for him she did once. Makeup and the whole thing. And,
were you guys the parents who went with the kids and were in costume as well?
No, we never did. We never did the costumes ourselves. I was always a little disappointed in that, but she was like, Terry had a hard line on Halloween. She's like, you can't, no adults dress up on Halloween.
That's
like,
so
really?
Funny.
Like, no, it's a kids' holiday, only the kids.
That's hilarious. So you didn't get your flight suit?
I did not get my flight suit.
You do have a kilt, though. So
I do have a kilt. Yeah. I have several kilts. So. Yeah, I think it is nice that the show, that this episode does get back to this personal thing at the end. But it does feel like we knitted this all together
mm-hmm.
thematically in a successful way through all the drama, on screen and off.
Yeah. And this is great, too, because, of course, she's standing there holding this secret, and he's saying, you know, you're so wonderful, and we're in this together. And
it helps a lot, the Murtaugh's on in the know.
Yep.
Like the three actors here are in such sync and
mm-hmm.
such good in the rhythm, and they know where each other is, and they play well off each other.
And it's always, you know, again, you're looking for the end of these episodes to make people kind of lean in, like, oh no, what's going to happen?
Yeah, what's going to happen
yeah.
next?
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. That's 203. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Ron.
It was a pleasure.
Yes.
And folks, we will talk to you again on episode 204. Until then, good night and good luck.